Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Read from Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 8, Chapter 9. The Lord incarnates as Mohini Murti. Text 12. Tata Grihitva Amrita Bhajanam Hari. Babasa Ishat Smita Shobaya Gira Yadi Abhyupetam Kva Cha Sadhu Asadhu Va Kritam Maya Va Vibhaje Sudham Imam Tato Grihitva Mrita Bhajanam Harir Babasa Ishat Smita Shobaya Gira Yadyabhyupetam Kvacha Sadva Saduva Kritam Mayavo Vibhaje Sudam Imam Tata, thereafter, Grihitva, taking possession of Amrita Bhajanam, the pot containing the nectar, Hari, the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Hari, in the form of Mohini. Babasha spoke. Ishat slightly. Abhyupetam. Well, Smita Shobaya Gira. With smiling beauty. And by words. Yadi, if Abhyupetam promised to be accepted. Kvacha,
whatever it may be.
Sadhu asaduva, whether honest or dishonest. Kritam Maya is done by me. Va unto you. Vibhaje, I shall give you the proper share. Sudham, nectar. Imam, this. Translation. Thereafter, the Supreme Personality of Godhead, having taken possession of the container of nectar, smiled slightly and spoke in attractive words. She said, "My dear demons, if you accept whatever I may do, whether honest or dishonest, then I can take responsibility for dividing the nectar among you." Please repeat. Thereafter, the Supreme Personality of Godhead, having taken possession of the container of nectar,
smiled slightly,
and spoke in attractive words. She said, "My dear demons, if you accept whatever I may do, whether honest or dishonest, then I can take responsibility for dividing the nectar among you." Purport by Srila Prabhupada. The Supreme Personality of Godhead cannot abide by anyone's dictation. Whatever he does is absolute. The demons, of course, were deluded by the illusory potency of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. And thus Mohini Murti got them to promise that whatever she would do, they would accept. Translation again. Thereafter, the Supreme Personality of Godhead, having taken possession of the container of nectar, smiled slightly and spoke in attractive words. She said, "My dear demons, if you accept whatever I may do, whether honest or dishonest, then I can take responsibility for dividing the nectar among you." So, although the Supreme Lord is all powerful and independent, still, he does not force the living entities. And in the case of the pot of nectar, the demons were in possession of it. And although the Lord could have taken it by force, he did not do so. In consideration of dharma or religious principles, the demons and devotees or demigods are always striving for supremacy over the other. And we find also in the eighth canto that at one stage the demons led by Bali Maharaj were successful by the grace of their spiritual master and the brahmanas. And the demigods were routed by them. And thus Bali Maharaj conquered the three worlds. The demigods appealed to Lord Vishnu to intervene and help them. And the Bhagavatam explains that because Bali Maharaj had conquered the three worlds by legitimate means in battle. The Lord could not, in consideration of religious principles, take it away by force. And so he assumed the form of a little Brahman, Vamanadeva, and begged charity from Bali Maharaj. The Lord accepts particular forms in consideration of the mentality of the devotee, or even in terms of the mentality of the demon. Bali Maharaj was born in the demon's family, but he was very charitably disposed towards Brahmins. And so the Lord, knowing Bali Maharaj's nature, assumed the form of a Brahmin and begged charity from him. But he did not take the universe back by force. Here too, the Lord assumed the form of Mohini Murti, knowing how lusty the demons are, and as Mohini Murti did not take the pot of nectar by force, but by her attractive features and joking words, inspired them to give her the pot of nectar voluntarily. Now, having received the pot of nectar from them, there is still the question of how to divide it, and she wanted to make sure that the demons agreed to let her divide it in whatever way she wanted. And they did agree. So one's agreement or one's word is very important. Although they were demons, still Mohini Murti considered that if they gave their word to allow her to deal with the nectar in whatever way she thought fit, that it would have some meaning. It would have some value. So the Lord respects the minute independence of the living entity. The first verse of Srimad Bhagavatam says, Janmadiyasiyataha, that the absolute truth is that from which everything emanates. So we living entities also emanate from the absolute truth, from Krishna. So we have the same qualities as Krishna, but in minute quantity. So one of Krishna's qualities is mentioned in the same verse, Swarat. Abhigya Swarat. Swarat means fully independent. So Krishna is fully independent. We have minute independence, which means we have free will. We are dependent by nature. We are dependent. So our minute independence is whether we want to surrender to Krishna or to Maya. We will always be surrendered, either to Krishna or to Maya. We cannot become fully independent like Krishna. And we find the same principle in the Bhagavad Gita. Krishna wanted Arjuna to fight against the Kauravas, but Krishna did not force him. And after speaking the whole Bhagavad Gita, he said, "You know, now you have heard whatever I have said, you deliberate on it, and you take your seat to Thakur, and whatever you like, you do." And Arjuna said, Smriti Labda, that now my memory has come back. Yesterday, His Holiness Lokanath Swami described the process of entanglement of the living entity and how the living entity ultimately falls down. Dhyayato Vishayam Pungsam, that when the senses dwell on the objects of the senses, attachment develops, and Sangat Sanjayate Kama, from attachment, lust develops, and from lust comes anger. From anger comes bewilderment of memory, smriti vimbrama. From bewilderment of memory, one's intelligence is lost, and then pranashiti, one falls down. So Arjuna, well, by the will of the Lord, we could say, but Arjuna was bewildered, he was confused, what to do and what not to do. And therefore he surrendered to the Lord as a disciple. Shishyasteham Shadimam Tvam Prapannam. It was when Arjuna admitted that he was confused about his duty and surrendered to Krishna, saying, "Shishyasteham, now I am your disciple and a soul surrendered unto you. Please instruct me." Then Krishna was able to speak the Bhagavad Gita to him. Up until then, he could not, because Arjuna was thinking that he was on the same level as Krishna, more or less on the same level. And they were arguing back and forth. But when Arjuna understood that this sort of arguing back and forth without any conclusion, this is not really helping me, then he surrendered to Krishna, and then Krishna could instruct him. And immediately Krishna chided him, that you're speaking learned words, but you are lamenting for that which is not worthy of grief. In other words, the body. You're lamenting for the body, and those who are wise do not lament for the body, either in the living condition or the dead condition. So Srila Prabhupada said that Krishna was calling him indirectly a fool. And Srila Tamakrishna Goswami's Vyas Puja Day, we heard from one disciple how Tamakrishna Goswami called her fool about 15 times within a few minutes. So, of course, that was out of affection. But this too, Krishna speaking to Arjuna, that's also out of affection. So he called him indirectly a fool. In other words, a wise man does not speak the way you are speaking. In other words, like Prabhupada gives the example, you say to someone, you do not look like an honest person. It's indirectly you're saying he's a thief. You're not speaking like a learned person. You're not speaking like a wise person. You are a fool. And when the disciple actually feels like a fool before the spiritual master, then he can receive transcendental knowledge. And the disciple always feels that way. A properly situated disciple always feels that way. Even in the liberated condition, we find in Sri Chaitanya Charitamrita that Lord Chaitanya explained that his spiritual master thought him to be a fool. Guru Murke Moradeki Karila Shashana. He said, my spiritual master considered me to be a fool and he chastised me. So Srila Prabhupada says that the disciple should always feel himself to be a fool before the spiritual master and be ready to be chastised by him. The context of this exchange between Lord Chaitanya and his spiritual master, Lord Chaitanya's spiritual master, Ishwara Puri, told him that you are not fit to study Vedanta. You should just chant the holy name of Krishna. So Lord Chaitanya took the instruction of his spiritual master and began to chant the holy name of Krishna. And he found that he was developing various symptoms, like singing, dancing like a madman, shivering, trembling, falling on the ground, rolling. He was developing so many symptoms, and he thought that perhaps by repeating this mantra, I'm becoming mad. He actually was thinking maybe he's becoming mad. So he approached his spiritual master to ask him, you know, what is happening? You told me to chant the names of Krishna. I've been chanting the names of Krishna. Now I'm manifesting different symptoms that suggest that I've gone mad. And his spiritual master replied, I am very pleased with you. These are symptoms of ecstatic love of Godhead. So you continue to chant the holy name and spread the holy name for the benefit of others. So Srila Prabhupada comments that these symptoms are possible only on the liberated platform. These are not phenomena that are induced by personal effort. They come when, by the grace of the Lord and the spiritual master, one comes to the liberated stage of bhava bhakti. Then these symptoms manifest. So Srila Prabhupada was making the point that although Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu had come to the liberated stage of ecstatic love of Godhead, still he consulted his spiritual master. He never considered himself to be independent. So that is our position. We are always dependent on Krishna, on Krishna's instructions, which come to us through disciplic succession. As long as we act in our dependent position, we are safe. And as soon as we artificially try to become independent, then we are in a very dangerous position. As we read yesterday, about Swaririnam, independent women, they're dangerous. They're in a dangerous position, dangerous for themselves and dangerous for others. But that applies to every living entity, as Lokanath Swami explained. Every living entity is prakriti. Only the Lord is Purusha. Therefore, only he is male, enjoyer, and all the living entities are female, meant to be enjoyed by the Lord. So we are not independent by nature. And when we act in our proper position as dependent on the Lord and his representatives, we are safe. And as soon as we want to imitate the Lord out of envy and try to act independently, then we are in trouble. But still, we always have our minute independence, either to voluntarily surrender to the Lord or to be forced to surrender to Maya. I like to tell the story of the young man who heard a talk by Srila Prabhupada in Seattle in 1968, and the young man said that he didn't feel that he had to bow down to anyone, that he should have to bow down to anyone. And Srila Prabhupada said, your nature is to bow down. You cannot avoid it. So the real question is where you can be happy, even by bowing down. He said, you can voluntarily bow down to Krishna and Krishna's representative, or you'll be forced to bow down to birth, disease, old age, and death. But you have to bow down. You're meant for bowing down. Your business is to bow down. You can't avoid it. The only question is, where you can bow down and be happy, even bowing down. And that is Krishna, Krishna's representative. Otherwise we'll be forced to bow down to Maya, to birth, disease, old age, and death. In the Bhagavad Gita also, Krishna says, Mrityu Sarva Harascha Ham, that Krishna is asking people to surrender voluntarily, Sarva Dharman Paritya Jama Mekam Saranam Vraja, to voluntarily give him the fruits of their activities, Yad Karosi. But if someone doesn't voluntarily give it, he will come as death and forcibly take it away. Mrityu Sarva Harascha Ham. So we don't have a choice whether to keep what we have, what we imagine is ours, or not, or give it. We don't have a choice. Our choice, our minute independence is whether we want to give it to Krishna voluntarily or whether we'll give it at the time of death involuntarily. And of course, if we give it to Krishna voluntarily, we get the credit. And if we try to hold on to it until the very end, then death will take it all away anyway. We won't get any credit for it. Rather, we'll be punished for our unlawful possession of another person's property, Krishna's property. So here, Mohini Murti, she's giving the demons the choice. First, to give her the pot of nectar or not. And they gave it to her. And now to accept willingly whatever she decides to do with the nectar. And they agree. They agree. And thus she, in a way you could say, cheated them. But actually the Lord is absolute. So his cheating is also beneficial. And because the Lord is absolute, we cannot judge him by our standards or insist that he conform to our standards of what should or should not be done. Srila Prabhupada raised this question to me at the Ardha Kumbha Mela in 1971, because as preachers, Prabhupada wanted us to know how to answer people's questions. So he raised the question that we tell people, you know, that you should follow these regulative principles. You know, no eating meat, fish, or eggs, no taking of intoxicants, no indulging in illicit sex life, or no gambling. But what if someone says to you, well, you say we shouldn't do these things, but you worship gods who do the very same things that you say we shouldn't do? And then he gave the example that Balaram, he gambled, played chess with Rukmi. Balaram also takes intoxicants, the Varuni beverage, and Krishna enjoys with the uh, like we heard yesterday, Matravat Paradarishu, one should say, Paradarishu means someone who belongs to someone else. And so the girl, you know, in her childhood, she's considered to belong to her father, and in her married life, she's considered to belong to her husband. So the Bhagavatam says the same thing about Krishna, that he enjoyed with women who belong to others, either their fathers or their husbands, which is against Dharma. So, of course, that's a separate topic. Once one man raised this question with Srila Prabhupada in a challenging way, that Krishna was dancing with other men's wives, enjoying with other men's wives. Isn't he guilty of adultery? And Srila Prabhupada replied that everything belongs to Krishna, every living entity belongs to Krishna, that everything is his property. Your wife also belongs to Krishna. So who's engaged in adultery? So, yes, but still, externally, he was dancing with other men's wives or with the unmarried ladies who are supposed to be protected by their fathers. So how do we answer this? That we worship deities who engage in activities that they say we shouldn't engage in. And eventually Srila Prabhupada gave the answer that the Lord is absolute. Whatever he does is all good. He gives the orders. He gives the laws for us, but he's above the law. Like Prabhupada would quote the British Constitution or something. The king can do no wrong. The citizens, they have to follow the orders of the king, but the king himself can do no wrong. He's above the orders because he's the one who gives the orders. So dharman shakshatu bhagavat pranitam. Dharma is the orders of God. He gives orders for us to follow, but he himself is above the orders. So of course sometimes he himself will voluntarily follow to set the example, as he says in the Bhagavad Gita, yad yad acharati shrestas, that whatever the leaders do, others follow. And so he, to set the example, follows the rules and regulations, although he himself is above them. But sometimes, especially in Vrindavan, he acts as the Supreme Personality of Godhead, and as the Supreme Personality of Godhead, he's the Supreme Enjoyer, Supreme Proprietor, the Supreme Controller, and he acts as the Supreme Personality of Godhead. And there's no fault. The same question is raised by Maharaj Parikshit, especially in relation to Krishna's activities with the gopis, that Krishna descended to establish dharma samstapanarthaya, yet he himself is acting contrary to dharma, or apparently so. And Sukadeva Goswami replied that actually the great controllers, they are not subject to the laws of ordinary people. And the example is given that the sun is so powerful it can evaporate urine from a dirty place, but the sun doesn't become contaminated. So the Ishwaras, the powerful controllers, they can engage in these activities, but they're not contaminated by them. And then Sukadeva Goswami gives a very important instruction, and he says that one should follow the example of the great controllers only insofar as their example is in accordance with their instructions. Welcome, Maharaj. Hare Krishna. But if there's a difference between what a powerful controller says, the instructions he gives, and his acts, you should follow his instructions. You should not imitate his actions. And the example is given of Lord Shiva. He could drink an ocean of poison. It was also part of the same pastime of churning the ocean of milk. He drank the whole ocean of poison, kept it in his throat. We can't do that. So if someone says, well, Lord Shiva, because that's not any other different forms of Lord Shiva, different expansions. But still, if someone says, well, Lord Shiva smokes ganja or something, so I will also smoke. So, but can you drink an ocean of poison? You know, first you drink an ocean of poison and you imitate Lord Shiva by smoke ganja, or, you know, well, Krishna danced with other, played with other late men's wives, so I will also do the same. But Krishna also lifted Govardhan Hill. Can you lift Govardhan Hill? First you lift Govardhan Hill, and you think of other things. So this is a very important principle. The Lord is independent, Swarat. He can do as he pleases, but that doesn't mean we can imitate him and do whatever we like. If we try to do that, we'll go to hell. We'll go to hell. And Sukadeva Goswami says that if one thinks of enjoying with women like Krishna did with the gopis, if one even has that thought, he's ruined. He's ruined. So we should accept our position as humble servants, dependent servants, and then we're safe and secure. And we should be happy that Krishna's enjoying. Of course, his enjoyment is completely pure. And his mood is really to give pleasure to his devotees, as their mood is to give pleasure to him. So although Krishna is independent, Swarat, but in Vrindavan, out of love for his devotees, he becomes as if dependent. He accepts Nanda as his father and Yashoda as his mother, and he acts as if he were dependent on them. Although, Krishna's providing everything for everyone. Nityo nitya nam, chaitanas chaitana nam, nam. Eka yog vidudati kaman. But still, he becomes dependent on Mother Yashoda to feed him. If she doesn't feed him, he's hungry, becomes angry, frustrated. And the gopis, Srila Prabhupada would often give the example of, one example is Ravana. He kidnapped Sita. He wanted to enjoy her, but actually she belonged to Ram. And because he wanted to enjoy the Lord's property, he and his entire family and kingdom were vanquished. So, Sita is Lakshmi. Everyone is chasing after Lakshmi, but Lakshmi is the property of Lord Narayan. So if we worship Lord Narayan, then automatically Lakshmi will be there. But if we want to snatch Lakshmi from Lord Narayan, we will be vanquished. So Srila Prabhupada said, every materialistic person is chasing after Lakshmi. But Lakshmi is chasing after Lord Narayan. She's always by the side of Lord Narayan. But then Srila Prabhupada said, except in Vrindavan. In Vrindavan, Lord Narayan as Krishna, of course Krishna is the origin, is chasing after Lakshmi, Radharani. So he's independent, but he becomes as if dependent on the love of his devotees. So, yeah, Prabhupada said the impersonals, they want to become one with God, but why should we want to become one with God? We can become mother of God, father of God, friend of God. And out of love, the Lord comes under the control of the devotee, or under the control of the love of the devotee. So the devotee doesn't think, well, what is this, becoming one with God? I can become greater, be in a higher position. Not really, because everyone is ultimately subordinate to the Lord, but the Lord will voluntarily come under the control of the pure devotee who has no other desire than to serve and please the Lord in pure love. Hare Krishna. Are there any questions or comments? Rasi Kendra Prabhu?
Interesting, this verse. Mohimuti is saying that whether my actions are honest or dishonest, you'll accept that. I mean, she's already hinting to them that her actions may be dishonest, but the demons went with a proposal, even though knowing that she may be dishonest in her dealings. So why is that? Why are the demons went with a proposal?
Well, in the next verse and purport, Srila Prabhupada says it appears that the demons were not very expert in making good decisions. Yeah, they were bewildered. They were bewildered by her charms, and they accept it. It happens in the material world. People know something is wrong, but out of some attachment for another person, they do things that are wrong, and they get into trouble. Yeah. Yes. Their buddhi-nasha, their intelligence was lost because of their lust.
Also, Mark has indicated earlier that they were thinking that Pini was joking also. She was speaking in a joking way. So they weren't separating what was the truth and not the truth in her joke. They were taking her not as a word, completely. They were accepting what she wanted them to do, not so much what she was saying, but also what she wanted them to do.
And yes.
So actually, it wasn't sharp intelligence that was working.
That's right. What Nityananda Prabhu said is true, that they, because she was sort of smiling all the time and she was so attractive, they were bewildered. They thought she was just joking. That it was all like sweet nothings. It's like, sweet, it doesn't matter what she's saying. Yeah, that's a good word, abominable. Because actually, Maharaj Pariksit used the same word in Jagupsitam, abominable. Well, the activities are abominable for us. But not for Krishna, not even for, you know, other powerful controllers. It's like once a devotee asked Srila Prabhupada that, well, if these things are bad for us, when we're conditioned, so then that means when we're liberated, we can, you know, have sex as much as we want. And Srila Prabhupada told a story of a king. He would ride in a boat, and he had a servant who would walk along the side, the shore, pulling the boat. It was just like a pleasure for the king to go just along the shore. But along the side, there were so many, thorns and stones and things. So the king was so pleased with the service of his attendant that he told the attendant that, I'm pleased with you, I will give you whatever you want. So then he asked, well, I would like the path along the river to be covered with velvet carpet. So this is like a pretty stupid, you know, he could have gotten his own kingdom, you know. He's just thinking in his terms that he has to pull the boat, so if he has to keep pulling the boat, then at least he should have a soft carpet under his feet. So Srila Prabhupada was making the point, you know, when you're liberated, you know, you can enjoy loving pastimes with Krishna that are those loving pastimes with Krishna are millions of times more pleasurable than the happiness of impersonal Brahman. And the happiness of impersonal Brahman is, you know, millions of times greater than the happiness of the material world, which from the point of view of a liberated soul is actually suffering. So, yeah, to think like, boy, if I become Krishna conscious, if I become liberated, I can have to enjoy with women, I can drink, I can take intoxicants, I can do whatever I want. It's like, you're not like getting it, what it means to be Krishna conscious. It's like, when you're Krishna conscious, like Yamunacharya said, when he would think of his enjoyment with women, his lips would curl in disgust and he would spit at the thought. It was just like so disgusting. So those activities on the material plane are always abominable, whether you're liberated or conditioned.
But you can't do that with a spiritual master. You can't do that with the, senior devotees who are giving shelter to the devotees. What is the difference? What makes it much worse now?
Well, I think what we're talking about here, yeah, there's a couple of things. If one offends Krishna, one can take shelter of the holy name. But if one offends the holy name, he has no other shelter. And so there are 10 offenses against the holy name. And, you know, offending a devotee, sadhaninda, guru avagya. Those are the very serious. Hatimata, Lord Chaitanya describes Vaishnava aparad as the mad elephant, that you can carefully cultivate a garden, but if a mad elephant enters, he'll just cause havoc, he'll just uproot everything and trample everything and destroy everything. Krishna takes offenses to his devotees more seriously than he takes offenses to himself. An example is given that someone is walking barefoot in the scorching heat. The heat on one's head, it isn't as painful as the heat under one's feet. So that way Krishna, he takes offenses against his devotees more seriously. I'm not sure if that...
I'm just thinking why, of course, Krishna's sweet will choose to take those offenses more seriously. I was thinking about the why. I was asking a similar question, not beginning to chanting, but why would Krishna want to take that more seriously? Is there another reason, or is it just the sweet will that he's decided that if anybody offends my devotees, you will watch out because I've just decided that?
Well, no, it's out of affection. It's like, a mother, if someone harms her small child, that'll affect her more than if someone harms her directly. Sort of a natural affection. And, it's just...
the affection.
Yeah. And also, the devotees are the ones who work on behalf of Krishna to give the holy name. So that's what Bhaktivinoda Thakur says in Harinam Chintamani, that the devotees are the well-wishers who give the holy name. The holy name is Krishna in the most accessible form. You know, by chanting the holy name we can realize Krishna. So if we turn against the people who've given us the holy name, who are our best well-wishers, the holy name is offended, and we're like cutting ourselves off from the source of mercy. So it's like if they don't bite the hand that feeds you. It's like the Vaishnavas are acting on behalf of Krishna to give people the holy name, give people the science of devotion. So if you turn against the very well-wishers who are trying to help you, then it's like the worst offense. And because they're doing that work on behalf of Krishna, they're the dearmost servants of Krishna. So he becomes very upset when his dear servants are mistreated.
Yesterday, Lokanath Swami was mentioning the alarming divorce rate that's always climbing. And I was thinking that there's a lot of divorce amongst devotees, and most devotees, when you talk to them, they say that divorce was necessary in their life. You know, they're either in some arranged marriage or some situation that wasn't right, and they got divorced and found Mr. or Mrs. Right, and they got remarried and lived happily ever after. So we wonder why there's so much criticism of divorce. There's a lot of people feel there's a need for divorce and that it's work for them. So I just wanted to ask you about that.
I was going to ask Maharaj the same question yesterday, but he didn't have time to answer, because I knew it would come in people's minds. You know, the basic, if I was going to phrase the question as I had it planned, you know, I would have quoted different situations. One situation is, you know, the husband and wife, like one's Krishna conscious and the other's not. Another situation is, at the time of marriage, both were Krishna conscious, but then one falls from the standard. And the third is, both are Krishna conscious, but they don't feel happy with each other. Now, the answer, according to Shastra, is that I was almost going to mention it in the class, that Guru Nasasyat Pita Nasasyat, that no one should become a guru or teacher, a father, a mother, a husband, or a superior relative, unless he can deliver his dependent from the repetition of birth and death, which means as Prabhupada explains in the purport, he or she should be a pure devotee. And you know the definition of pure devotee, someone who's always endeavoring to, you know, to chant the holy name and engage in devotional service without offenses. So, I think if they're both Krishna conscious, but they feel they're not compatible, they're not both Krishna conscious. Because if they really were both Krishna conscious, they wouldn't be compatible on the basis of being Krishna conscious. If they feel, you know, they're both Krishna conscious but they're not compatible, it really means they're not Krishna conscious. I just read it, actually, in one of Prabhupada's books. Again, the sixth canto, the story of Ajamil. Ajamil had a very beautiful, chaste wife, but he got enamored of a prostitute. And for the sake of the prostitute, you know, for the sake of his sense gratification, he left his chaste, beautiful wife. Was a Brahmin. He was a Brahmin. She was a Brahmin. This was after hearing the discussion between the Yamadutas and Vishnudutas and coming to his senses. And then he was lamenting, you know, how he had neglected his parents in their old age for the sake of the prostitute, and he had left his chaste Brahmin wife for the sake of the prostitute. It means for the sake of sense gratification. And Srila Prabhupada explains that people should marry in the same category. Like a Brahmin man should marry a Brahmin woman. A Kshatriya man should marry a Kshatriya woman. And so on. Because marriages work better if both are on the same level. That came up with Krishna and Rukmini, his first queen in Dwarka. He was joking, but he was saying, you know, when Krishna jokes, there's a lot of truth in his jokes. So he was joking with Rukmini that he wasn't qualified to be her husband because, you know, she was the daughter of a king. She was highly qualified, and he was like known as being a cowherd, which is like on a lower level. But even then, no one's really quite sure what he is. If he's a Kshatriya or Vaishya, so it's like he's almost without any caste. And so he was like going through all the ways in which she was more qualified than he was. And in his joking way, he suggested, you know, you should marry someone else. You know, I'm not fit to be your husband, you should marry someone else. So he was teasing her because she was always very docile and submissive, like an Adhar Pandit in Chaitanya Leela. So he wanted to tease her so she'd become angry. He wanted to see that angry side of her. But she was so, you know, docile and submissive and simple that she thought Krishna was serious, and she just collapsed on the ground. She fainted. She just couldn't bear the thought of being separated from Krishna. But within the joking words, there's truth that the husband and wife should be of a similar standard, education, culture, family heritage, And for devotees, the main thing is Krishna consciousness. And in the purport, Srila Prabhupada says that but if the husband and wife are both Krishna conscious, that itself is sufficient. The other considerations are immaterial if the husband and wife are Krishna conscious. Now, so that's the question. How Krishna conscious are we? So we have Varnashram Dharma. Varnashram Dharma is sort of the safety net, where if you're not Krishna conscious, really Krishna conscious, you don't fall all the way down to the bottom, but you get situated in Varnashram Dharma. And from a secure position in Varnashram Dharma, you can gradually become purified and become Krishna conscious. So in terms of Varnashram Dharma, the husband and wife should be of a similar standard, all the things we discussed. So that if there's a defect in their Krishna consciousness, they can still be situated in Varnashram Dharma. Divorce is a dharma, so Varnashram Dharma means they're not Krishna conscious. I mean, to some extent, but not fully. Not pure devotees. In other words, not pure devotees. But because they've observed the principles of Varnashram Dharma, they can maintain a certain position and then gradually become purified and elevated. So Rasaraj Prabhu.
Thank you for the wonderful class, Maharaj. I had a question on a point that you made about dependence.
Wait, maybe I should just complete this, because there is a verse in the Bhagavatam that says the chaste wife should faithfully serve her husband who's not fallen. So it is a regulation that the wife should serve the husband, but the verse in the Bhagavatam says, this is the seventh canto about ideal family life, that a chaste wife should faithfully serve a husband who's not fallen. And in the purport, Srila Prabhupada explains that, you know, if the husband isn't following the basic principles of Krishna consciousness, the wife is not obliged to serve him. But other than that, the Shastra says she should. You know, the fact that he's like temperamental or something like that doesn't excuse her from her obligation to serve him. But as long as he's not fallen. And then, of course, we're in that sort of gray area that he may have fallen, but you're hoping he'll come back to the standard. You give him time. You know, there could be but that's the basic principle. So yeah, I just wanted to come add that to the previous answer.
So there's this material dependence, and then within spiritual dependence there is religious variations. Can you understand?
Well, for householders, Srila Prabhupada said financially independent and spiritually dependent. The context of the statement was that there was you know, in the history of ISKCON, there was a time when the householders were living in the temples and were dependent on the temple. But it became an awkward situation. And Srila Prabhupada said basically the householders should maintain themselves. But they should still live near the temple so that they could be in the association of devotees. And that's when he said financially independent but spiritually dependent. He said he could live away from the devotees. You know, Bhaktivinoda Thakur could live away from the devotees because they were very strong. But if neophytes live away from the devotees, as he said, they'll become infected by the karmi's poison. So they should live near the devotees, but maintain themselves. So then he said, you know, financially independent but spiritually dependent. As far as how to get direction in the absence of the spiritual master, I mean, that's been a topic that we've been discussing. Sadhu Shastra and Guru, but you know, they're the instructions that the spiritual master gave. You know, he lives forever by his divine instructions and the follower lives with him. So the instructions that he gave continue. And then the books, either the books that he's left us or Srila Prabhupada's books, because in ISKCON the spiritual masters are all representing Srila Prabhupada, get guidance from the books. Bhagavad Purana, brilliant as the sun. And sadhus, shikshagurus, they can also guide us. There was one quotation by Srila Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati Thakur that my spiritual master resides in different personalities. And those who are dear to my Gurudev, they are like my well-wishers. Something to that effect. Like Prabhupada said, anyone who's teaching you purely what your spiritual master has taught you, he can, you know, be accepted. So, Prabhu, teachers, sadhu. Really depends on the sincerity of the person. If he wants guidance, his guru will arrange for him to get the guidance he needs. But if he's actually looking for an excuse to be independent, you know, no, my Guru Maharaj is gone, there's no guidance for me, I'll just have to make up my own decisions. If he's looking for an excuse, well, that's okay, that's his choice. Itejasi Tathakru, that's his choice. But if he's choosing to be independent, he has to live with the consequences of it. But if he genuinely wants guidance from the Guru will arrange it.
Then it becomes very difficult.
Well, this is a very good point. There are different, you could say, categories of Shiksha Gurus, different relationships one can have with a Shiksha Guru. You know, there's like general Shiksha Gurus, like every devotee is a Shiksha Guru, and that they are repeating the message of Krishna and you can get good instruction from them. But then among so many devotees, there may be a few whose instructions you take more seriously. So they're also Shiksha Gurus, but they're more particular guides for you. And then it could come to the stage where where there's one, it wouldn't even have to be limited to one, but where you feel like, you know, you really want inquire of this person and take instruction from this person, serve this person. And then it's just like with the original spiritual master, it's a question of both parties agreeing. And sometimes it's like that, and sometimes it might not be like that. Just as in the case of the original spiritual master. But say in the case of Raghunath Das Goswami, he, you know, after Chaitanya Mahaprabhu left, he took shelter of Rupa and Sanatana, especially Rupa Goswami. And Rupa and Sanatana, they accepted him like their younger brother. So it was reciprocal. That has to be there. But there's even, yeah, sadhu sangha svatovare, svajatiya snigde, that those are all there. Sadhu sangha, the definition of sadhu sangha is to advance with, associate with someone who's more advanced. And who has a similar affection for the Lord, similar mood of service, and who's also affectionate to you. Someone may be advanced, more advanced than you. Maybe many devotees were more advanced than you, but there has to be that affectionate relationship for the sadhu sangha in that particular way to be effective. But general, you hear from advanced devotees, you hear, you learn, you try to follow the instructions. But beyond that, there's no commitment of the speaker. No responsibility. No, this is a good question, and this is not an excuse, but I actually do need to go out for a minute, so you can chant or discuss. I'll be right back. Just got the answer. Well, this is a good question. You're saying that the husband and wife get married before either is Krishna conscious. Then one becomes Krishna conscious and the other doesn't. So within that general case, there's two possibilities in broad terms. One is the husband, let's say the husband is the one who's not Krishna conscious. The husband is he lets his wife practice. He just doesn't want to himself. It's like, it's that way in any relationship that one party will be into something that the other party's not into. Like, say they're both are non-devotees. The husband might be into football, but the wife might not be. But okay, she doesn't mind. He wants to, you know, go to the football game with some of his buddies or sit and watch the Super Bowl and drink beer with his buddies, you know. But that's not her thing. She's not part of it, but she lets him do it. So, it could be like that. But another case is that the husband is actually inimical. But even then, why should he be inimical? It usually means there's like something going on, you know, that he feels insecure or threatened or has a misconception. So I would say, I mean, a divorce should be avoided at all costs, because it's such a, it's really bad for both the husband and wife, and it's terrible for the children. I mean, both boys and girls need both parents. It's just the way it is. They both need a father. You know, both a boy and a girl need a father, and both a boy and a girl need a mother. And any sort of divorce is going to bring heartbreak, well, both to the spouses and to the children. But the children are more helpless and vulnerable. They can't really deal with it in the same ways that the adults can deal with the heartbreak and trauma. So I would think they should work on it, finding a solution that doesn't involve divorce.
Lord, in the highest standing, so how is it they are glorious for staying with abusive evil lessons?
You see, they're actually very good questions. As I mentioned, there's Varnashram Dharma, and then there's spiritual life, Krishna consciousness. Someone can be in Varnashram Dharma and still be a demon. Like, one of the reasons that the Pandavas didn't want to fight with the Kauravas is because even though they were against Krishna, but they were still ruling properly according to Varnashram Dharma. So we shouldn't confuse, you know, Vedic culture or Varnashram Dharma with Krishna consciousness. Like, I was friends with the Maharana of Udaipur, and he, like we read on Wednesday night about when Srila Gurudev discovered the deity of Krishna in the sands of Juhu Beach and took up the work, the worship, and then the Maharana's niece, she wanted to take up the service of getting a Radharani maid to go with the Krishna. So once I visited the Maharana with another devotee, and the Maharana was saying how his brother was a demon, and the other devotee who was with me was saying, no, I don't think that's true, because I met him, and, you know, he received me very nicely, he invited me in, he gave me water to drink, and, you know, he gave me some fruit. I don't think that's true. And the Maharana replied, oh, that's just culture. He's still a demon. because he's inimical to Krishna and Krishna consciousness. That's just normal culture. You receive someone, you speak nicely, you give him a place to sit, you give him something to drink, give him some food to eat. That's just culture. So, Dhritarashtra was a demon because he opposed Krishna. But it doesn't mean he wasn't a cultured person in terms of Varnashram Dharma. It doesn't mean he wasn't a proper husband. Even Ravana, he was considered a great Brahmin. He was a very learned scholar. He had many good qualities in Vedic terms, but his defect, and he was a great devotee of Lord Shiva. His defect was that he was envious of Ram. So, in that context of Vedic culture, the wife, it's her duty to serve her husband. And, you know, Gandhari, like you said, Gandhari and Mandodara, they're considered among the great chaste ladies of the world. You know, the fact that the Bhagavatam says that, you know, it's the duty of the chaste wife to faithfully serve a husband who's not fallen doesn't mean that as soon as the wife sees, oh, he's fallen, you know. He ate with his left hand. He's fallen. I don't have to serve him. I'm going shopping. It doesn't mean that one goes for separation or divorce, but because they're such heavy, such strong injunctions for the woman to serve the husband, for the wife to serve the husband, it's mentioned in the Bhagavatam if the husband has not fallen. But it doesn't mean that there's divorce or remarriage in the Vedic culture. You know, we had a, we had a very temperamental man in Bombay. Narayan, it's no secret. Very temperamental person. And he had a wife named Dina Dayadri, was considered very saintly. And he would lose his temper and beat her and really a bad situation. Now, of course, this was like almost 35 years ago. And Prabhupada was present. It was a different situation. But, you know, Prabhupada said, well, it's just like her bad luck in this life, but she should tolerate it. But everyone was like, really, their sentiments were really for her. She's so saintly, appeared to be so saintly. And eventually she left him. She went to the Detroit temple, and she was trying for a while, you know, to follow everything, but she couldn't. Either she wasn't strong enough, or maybe she was, she suffered because she disobeyed Prabhupada's. That was a special case, it was a direct instruction. And in the end she married a Karmi. And this lady who was so saintly, you know, ended up in a pretty miserable condition. I don't know where she is now. Um, you know, I've heard different devotees have made the same comment. His Holiness Keshava Bharati Das Goswami Maharaj also made the same comment that I'm speaking more to the wife because of the injunction that she should follow the husband. But if you're having a difficult time with your husband, I mean, this case where Keshava Bharati Maharaj gave the instruction, it was like that. They were both, neither had any knowledge of Krishna consciousness when they got married. They were already like, they already had like two grown children, and the wife became Krishna conscious and the husband didn't, and he was very, I think he felt very threatened, and he was, I think, just ignorant and prejudiced. But Keshava Bharati Maharaj said you should take it as practice for surrendering to Krishna. You know, that you have to accept some difficulty, take it as practice for surrendering to Krishna. You could even take it as practice, as surrender to Krishna, to tolerate the difficulty. But of course, then we get into this ambiguous area of how much you should tolerate and how much you can tolerate. And Prabhupada also said, you know, in Kali Yuga we can't expect the women to conform to that role model exactly, or the men. There's to be more give and take in the relationship than you might get the sense just from reading the Bhagavatam.
Consider what you're taking in mind. It's very difficult stuff in a marriage situation for a couple. That's what it is. It's very difficult. That's why the reliance on the holy name is so much more important.
Yeah, what Nityananda Prabhu said. In fact, I was thinking of saying it and I didn't say it, and then you more or less said the same thing. When there was some controversy in Mayapur, that was like between Grihastas and Sannyasis, and each side pointing the finger, and Prabhupada said that if, you know, that in Kali Yuga everyone has faults, you know, and if we, you know, he said in Kali Yuga no one can follow perfectly. And in Kali Yuga, no one can follow perfectly. You know, you have faults, I have faults, everyone has faults. But if we simply spend our time pointing out the faults of the others, then our whole spiritual life will be lost. And then, with reference to that point that in Kali Yuga, no one can follow perfectly, so therefore Chaitanya Mahaprabhu gave the holy name. That can save us, anyone and everyone. Ladini Shakti Prabhu?
I don't know how relevant it may be, but it occurs to me that Prabhupada also used the Bengali proverb, I think, to the effect that when you go to Benares, your forehead goes to Benares.
Very profound statement. Vaidini Shakti Prabhu said that we may be placed in a particular situation for our own purification, because we're meant to learn something. And if we try to escape the situation without having learned what we're meant to have learned from it, they just end up in another situation that's meant to teach us the same thing that we tried to run away from. And I've seen it. There was one case in South Africa. The man was a Prabhupada disciple, good devotee. He's a good devotee. And he married, a British lady. He was American. And, you know, she wasn't that submissive, that serious in Krishna consciousness. And in those days, it was like really a big thing to get divorced. I mean, in ISKCON, it's like you just didn't get divorced. But anyway, it just reached this. I think she just left him and went back to England, and they got divorced. But he still felt the need to be married. So, okay, everyone like rallied together, like, okay, we can't let this happen again. So they chose a girl who was a Gurukul teacher of Indian origin. Like very submissive, docile, just hardly ever spoke. Said, okay, all right, this is not going to happen again. It's got to really make this work. So they got married, and I don't know how long it took, but another feature of that submissive, docile, quiet cruel teacher came out, and she was just like the other one. She was just like the other one. And it was really rocky, I mean stormy, you know, tempestuous. But they didn't divorce. And I think the reason he didn't divorce her is that he realized that it was the same situation as the last time. And that if he tried to like take the easy way out and get divorced and marry again, the same thing could happen a third time. And it would just be a complete disgrace and humiliation. So they stuck it out. You know, I don't know, you know, internally, but I know they, what it is, I'm sure that with age and maturity they've, I don't know. Yeah, but they did stick it out. They did stick it out. They had a child. They stayed together. Maybe they even had two, I don't, but they stayed together, and I think that's true. Tate dukampam susumikshamana, that we should take whatever's happened to us as the Lord's mercy. And take the situation as an occasion to surrender more to the Lord. Beautiful point. Stella, and then go. Yes. Yeah. Yeah. Any woman who has any questions, just ask Bhaktin Stella. She'll. Okay, before things get too out of hand here, you in the men's corner, you in the women's corner. Will you pray for me? Your prayers are really powerful. I hope you pray for me. Yeah, there was another, I don't know the details, but it sounds comparable. The lady was very religious, very devout from her childhood. I think she was Catholic, not sure. And, you know, she always wanted a husband who would like be a partner with her in her spiritual pursuit. And then after so many years, like, she fell in love with someone, and it turns out he didn't believe in God. And she was, God, why did you do this? Like, you know, I just wanted to serve you and love you, and I wanted a husband that would be with me in it. Why did you make me fall in love with someone who doesn't even believe in you? Now, I don't know how it happened, but pretty soon after she, I don't even know if it was simultaneous, but anyway, they both became Krishna conscious, both became devotees. So, but I think that's very good about not being on an ego trip and trying to force something on someone. That applies between spouses, it applies to children, parents and children as well. If you give them the time and space and freedom, they may come to it on their own. And prayer, of course. But if you try to enforce it on them, they might rebel against it. I've seen it. One mother, she's like a very heavy type of person. She had two daughters. They like raised them nicely. They seemed very nice. And when I went back to Bombay, you know, I met her and two daughters. And you know, you don't really know, but the daughters seemed pretty nice. You know, pretty nice. I've known them since they were little. But the mother was just so heavy, you know, so they would pull away more as a reaction to the mother than because they wanted to be away from Krishna consciousness. And it was just so apparent. It wasn't the Krishna consciousness that they were withdrawing from, but they were withdrawing from the mother's heaviness and insistence, and you know. That's very, and I've heard, yeah, once, I mean, there could be so many variations, but once Shesha Prabhu and his wife came to visit us in Santa Barbara, their two daughters are really nice devotees, and we asked them, how did you do it, you know? And they said they never instructed their daughters to do anything. They would have their own morning program. They would do what they wanted to do as devotees. They'd have their own morning program. They'd invite sadhus. They'd invite other devotees. They'd have programs. They'd go to the temple. But they never directly instructed the daughters to do anything. They let the daughters do whatever they wanted, and the daughters, and there, of course, there's a very strong relationship between husband and wife and between the parents and the children. So in that context, the daughters themselves, you know, they would join in the activities, join in serving the guests, and they became devotees. And we had coincidentally at our place in Santa Barbara, Carpinteria, this very nice couple, Nandakishore and Kandarpa Manjari from South Africa, They're so sweet. So sweet devotees. So we asked them, like, what, from their point of view, how did they choose to be devotees? Yes, they're both parents, the husbands, they're young. I mean, you know, they're early 20s. But the parents of both were devotees, initiated devotees. And so we asked them, like, from their point of view, what, how they ended up becoming devotees. And they both said that they appreciated the fact that their parents didn't try to force them. I don't know about the girl side so much. I know the boy side, the parent, it's the same thing. Relationship between the husband and wife is good. Between the parents and children is strong. And they're good devotees. But they both said that they appreciated not having it forced on them or thrust upon them. That they were allowed to make their own decision.
And I think the most important thing is to love the person, to show your love, to really improve your spouse's ability to just love them. Just love them. I mean, how can you do this if the love is there, not the, you know. I mean,
that's
I think
right.
The children, not quite just loving them up. Just love them so much unconditionally, and then they see the principles of the religion in their own experience of that love.
Will you become my mother? What she said is true. I mean, it reaches such a deep place in everyone's heart. It's just absolutely true. Yes.
Hare Krishna Maharaj. This is a question of dependence on Krishna. Maharaj, generally we seek the guidance of our authorities or our spiritual master only when some major problem occurs in our life or major issue arises. But then there are decisions we need to make on a day-to-day basis. And then there are cases when you seek the advice of the authority, but you don't get a clear answer to this or that. They tell you the general principle and leave the rest on your intelligence. So my question is, as long as you have to make even a single decision yourself, how can you hope to be fully dependent on Krishna?
That's a good question. That's a good question. You see, the guidance can come, directly from the spiritual master, the authority. But again, if you're sincere, you can get the answer even if they don't give you the answer. You know, there's this one case of mine where after I'd been preaching in India for a while, Srila Prabhupada, I met Prabhupada in Mayapur, and he said that during the British rule, they had three provinces, Bombay, Calcutta, and Madras. So which do you want? So I said, well, Srila Prabhupada, I'll do whatever you tell me. Just tell me what you want me to do and I'll do it. He said, no, I want you to decide. But later I realized that he was forcing me to come to a deeper level of surrender, to know what he would want me to do without him telling me. Like we hear there are three levels of students or sons or daughters or disciples. On the lowest level, the disciple will get an instruction and argue or begrudge it or forget. On the middle level, the disciple will get an instruction and execute it perfectly. And on the highest level, the disciple will know what the spiritual master wants even without the spiritual master telling him. Now, most of us begin on the third level, so our constant meditation should be, you know, what does the spiritual master want me to do at every moment? I remember I went through a phase where I was thinking like that. You know, what does Krishna want? And it was so like I would be taking prasad, and I would, you know, at a certain stage I would think, okay, does Krishna want me to have more? And sometimes I sort of knew he didn't want me to have more, but I would still try to sneak in an extra mouthful or two. But afterwards I felt bad. It wasn't just that I had an extra mouthful or two, but it was like a breach in my relationship with Krishna, that I felt he wanted me to stop, you know, that it would be better for my Krishna consciousness if I stopped, but I didn't. So that should be our meditation. But and then sometimes you can't, I guess there's another way of looking at it, which educators talk about. This is four levels. One is unconscious incompetence. It's like you're incompetent, but you don't know it. Like many devotees, they chant inattentively. They don't even know they're chanting inattentively. They don't even know what attentive chanting is. Then the next level is conscious incompetence. It's like you know you're incompetent, but at least you're aware of it. Then the next level is conscious competence. Like, you know you have this problem, but you're working on it, and you're able to get it right, but you always have to be very careful to get it right. And that's like, you could say that's like the clearing stage. More advanced stage of clearing, where you make an effort to bring your mind on to the holy name. And then the highest is unconscious competence. In other words, your competence becomes so natural to you that you don't even have to think about it. Like when you come to the stage of a shakti, it's like they say, if our mind wanders, we don't even know when it started to wander or how it started to wander. And so many beads go, maybe even so many malas go, and we realize, oh my God, I didn't hear one word. You know, my mind was somewhere else. But in this more advanced stage, it's like you don't know, your mind naturally goes to Krishna. It's like you don't know how it got there, but it's there and it stays there. Or walking. You know, a baby will try to stand up, fall down. You know, try to take a step or two, fall down. But then by practice, so then they're careful. They're like riding a bicycle, a two-wheeler. You know, you're careful, you have to be careful so you don't lose your balance. That's like conscious confidence. But then it becomes natural. You don't even think about it. (Clears throat) So if you don't ask an authority, it shouldn't be an excuse for doing what you want to do. But you should try to make the decision without bothering the authority, either by consulting others or by chanting, praying, you know, whatever it is. It should never be an excuse for laziness or negligence. And again, the main thing is, if you're sincere and you really want the guidance, you'll get it. Rohit? Yeah, some of the activities are in the spiritual world. Not everything that's in the material world exists in the spiritual world, but the feeling that they exist is there. Like in the spiritual world, there are no demons, but there's a rasa in being afraid for Krishna's welfare on account of demons. So they say there's talk in the spiritual world that they're demons, that the demons are coming, we have to protect Krishna. Rumors. And similarly, there are no real husbands of the gopis, but there's the sentiment that they're married. It's a little difficult, but there's sort of like a sort of shadow of husbands. As far as gambling, I suppose they played chess at Dwarka, and part of Radha and Krishna's midday pastimes at Radhakund, sometimes Radha and Krishna play dice. As far as taking intoxicants, I think the Varuni beverage is there, the spiritual world. I know about meat eating. Never came across that. I don't think I never came across that one.
You become inebriated when you take that.
Yeah. The real thing is that none of the words, whether Sanskrit or English, refer to are the same in the material world as in the spiritual world. You know, so the real thing is that everything in the spiritual world is eternal, full of knowledge and full of bliss. You know, it's all based on love. So yeah, they play dice, but it's all based on love. It's like, it's all lila. It's all play. It's not like one person wins and the other person loses. It's like everyone wins. Because it's all love. Everything is for the pleasure of everyone else. Yes. He says that during that 1 year that Brahma stole all the cowherd boys and calves when Krishna was having his picnic lunch. So Purnamasi announced that this is a very good time for marriages. So she got all the young girls to marry cowherd boys, but actually the cowherd boys were all Krishna. So they actually weren't marrying the other cowherd boys, they were all marrying Krishna.
I guess it was the devotees in the Gainesville temple, I remember.
Yeah. The competition was whether the Gainesville devotees could cook more prasad than the Radha Damodar party could eat. So each side was, you know, interpreting it in such a way that they had defeated the other, but actually in that one everyone lost because they all overate. I assume you're talking about Grihastas. Yeah, because, I mean, Lokanatha Swami is happy. Sindhudurya Swami is happy. Radhanatha Swami is happy. I mean, we're talking about Grihastas. Huh?
Yes, that's another thing.
Well, okay, well, I thought of two things here, and coincidentally, they're both from His Holiness Bhaktitirtha Swami, maybe because also his disappearance day coming up. But one of his female disciples had heard that he was, you know, he didn't tell her directly, but she heard that he wanted all of his female disciples to be married. And it was like troubling her. It was troubling her because I think she didn't want to get married. So finally she approached him directly and asked him. And he said, if you don't get married, you will suffer. And if you get married, you will suffer. The only question is whether you want to suffer alone or with someone else. Then the other thing he said was, with reference to the idea that if you're making progress, I think what you're thinking is if you make progress, then at a certain stage you don't struggle. But I don't think that's the case. You always struggle. But your internal happiness increases, but you still struggle. Even preachers, they struggle till the end. Prabhupada, you know, struggled to the end. And what Bhaktitirtha Swami said about that was that as you make advancement, it becomes more difficult, but it's not harder. In other words, the challenges are more difficult. I mean, this is how I'm taking it. The challenges are more difficult, but it's not harder for you to deal with them because you're better equipped to deal with them, because you're more mature, you're more purified, you have more resources, more knowledge, more support. But there's always tests. In fact, in one class he gave years ago, in Juhu actually, he was saying like, Krishna always gives us tests, and when we pass one test, then we go on to the next test. And that's how we make advancement. And we keep making advancement until the final test, which is the time of death. So there will always be tests. But when we pass the tests, we make advancement. There will always be struggles. But internally, the devotee is relishing. At least in the line of preachers, preachers are always struggling to give Krishna to others. In fact, that was, one talk Prabhupada gave in Gorakhpur, saying that as long as you're preaching, there's going to be opposition. There's going to be difficulty. There's going to be struggle. But in the course of it, Krishna's pleased. Because Krishna's pleased, our lives are successful. And we take pleasure in Krishna's happiness, even though externally there's difficulty. So it's like that. And I also was like that. I thought, well, it's a subtle form of fruitive, sort of like, okay, I'll work hard and then things will get established and then I'll take it easy. And then at a certain stage, I just realized it's never going to stop. There's always going to be weeds. I mean, externally, no question, but even internally within ISKCON, within the hearts of devotees, there's always going to be weeds. We always have to be vigilant. We always have to, isolate the weeds. We have to pull them out. It's never going to end. That's our service. It's like I guess at one stage Bhakti Swarup Damodar Maharaj is feeling discouraged because there are like so many problems. And he asked Srila Prabhupada, how do you keep up your enthusiasm all the time when there's so many problems? And Prabhupada said, I don't see any problems. I just see service to my spiritual master. So, okay, there's a weed there. We have to pull it out. So we say, oh, it's a problem. Why do I have to deal with that ugly weed? Why do I have to get my hands dirty? But as a servant, it's just service. Pulling out the weed, it's service to the master. Picking the rose flower and offering it to the deity's lotus feet is service to the spirit. It's just service. Just varieties of service. Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
I mentioned those because I knew that he knew them.
Yeah.
Maybe you need to invite more happy householders. So people can see it's possible. Carl and Stella are happy. I'm sure they're ready. Okay. Srila Prabhupada ki jai. Jai Gaur Prabhupada.
Jai Gaur Prabhupada ki jai. Jai Gaur Prabhupada ki jai.